This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
The Exorcist came out 50 years ago, and it's still widely considered one of the greatest horror movies of all time. Now, The Exorcist Believer serves as both a reboot and a sequel. It's got a mostly new cast of characters, but it also brings back Ellen Burstyn to return to her iconic role from the original film. But how does the new one stack up? I'm Stephen Thompson. Today, we are talking about The Exorcist Believer on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is NPR producer Mark Rivers. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Stephen. Great to be back.
Also with us, Jordan Cruciola. She's a writer and producer and the host of the podcast Feeling Seen on Maximum Fun. Hey, Jordan.
Hello. Happy October. Happy to be back with you.
Happy to have you. Also rounding out the panel, Switched On Pop producer Rihanna Cruz. Hi, Rihanna.
Hey.
It's great to have you all here. So The Exorcist Believer takes place 50 years after the events of the original film, in which a young girl is possessed by demonic forces. This time around, two girls are possessed after they take a walk into the woods. Angela, played by Lydia Jewett, is the daughter of a widowed single father named Victor, played by Leslie Odom Jr. Angela and her friend Catherine, played by Olivia O'Neill, disappear for 3 days, only to be found with no memory of their experience. As you might suspect, they soon exhibit telltale signs of possession.
The body in the blood! The body in the blood!
Catherine!
The body in the blood!
Catherine!
The girls' parents seek help, which leads to a variety of religious interventions, thanks in part to Victor's neighbor, a nurse played by Anne Dowd. And Victor is compelled to seek the counsel of Chris McNeil, played by Ellen Burstyn. Her daughter Reagan was possessed in the very first Exorcist movie. Soon enough, it's priests and incantations and Catholic iconography all the way down, as parents, community members, and religious figures work to purge the forces of possession. The Exorcist Believer was directed and co-written by David Gordon Green, whose recent work includes a return to the Halloween franchise, and as with those Halloween films, The Exorcist Believer is intended to be part of a new trilogy. The film is in theaters now. Rihanna Cruz, I'm going to start with you. What do you think of The Exorcist Believer?
This might be a little bit controversial, but I liked it. I definitely felt the length of the movie, but that's my primary drawback. I thought it was a pretty great horror movie by current 2020s horror movie standards. I didn't feel particularly scared, but I thought the acting was great, the plot was pretty great, and I was pretty on board with the maximalism aspects of it all, like the bigger, the better, 50 years later. What gets me about horror is when a movie is like unafraid to go there, and there were parts during Believer that I gasped in the theater because it did go there. So I can't really complain, you know? Perfect 3.5-star horror movie for me.
All right. Jordan Cruciola, how about you?
I think for the first time in my pop culture happy hour life, I am going to say that I didn't like the thing that I'm on here to talk about. But almost like saying I didn't like it almost affords the movie more of an emotional credit than I can give it for me personally. I was with another journalist sitting next to me when I watched it. And when it ended, I was like, I kept waiting for the movie to start. And now it's done. And the acting, full props to the acting. The cast does an excellent job. These little girls are giving it their all. There were two particular choices where I was like, all right.
Yeah.
That's a big swing. And I will nod to that. But outside of those sort of isolated moments of like, this one just really left me cold. And I hope it is the end of this attempted trilogy reboot of The Exorcist.
Yeah, Jordan, I'm right there with you. I mean, Rihanna, I think it's interesting that you said that you were surprised by the places that it was willing to go. I just feel like the original Exorcist already went to all the places that a movie like this would go. And if The Exorcist didn't go there, Talk to Me from this year went there, or The Conjuring, or pick any number of movies that have existed under the shadow of The Exorcist. But at this point, this just felt like a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. And with each new copy, the ink looks more and more faded with this movie. I kept on waiting for it to do something different. Like, by the time we got to where I think Green found an end to this story, That inn, I just did not buy at all. And I am baffled by the direction that David Gordon Green's career has taken from, like, you know, like that he has just decided that his new mission is to just, like, retcon these, like, horror franchises with these, like, pseudo-serious takes. It has not been a successful mission to me. And, yeah, I was out on this movie.
I do think he seems to have taken it upon himself to look at some of these iconic horror franchises and decide to revisit them while a few of members of the principal cast are still around to participate. And I think he sees some of the power in, like, bringing somebody back 50 years later and kind of revisiting how the events of the original film might have affected these characters. I think he is legitimately interested in that. But I had some of the same issues. I think it's very well acted. I think they got a pretty dynamite cast all the way down. I mean, Alan Burstyn, obviously. Leslie Odom Jr. is great.
Ann Dowd.
Wow. You got Ann Dowd in your movie. Ann Dowd's doing her whole Ann Dowd thing.
Yeah.
She's great. Both the girls, I think, are really solid. For me, every horror franchise is a Rorschach test in a lot of ways. Like, they're taking some, like, fundamental trauma, some fundamental fear that the audience might have, and they magnify it and point it back at you. And how you have lived your life and your perspective is going to color how strongly you respond to the horror franchise in question. I was emphatically not raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. I think the original Exorcist is terrific. Mm-hmm. When that movie came out, people were freaking traumatized.
Mm-hmm. My mom.
Oh, yeah. For me, like, I just don't have any of that foundation. So watching a movie about demonic possession is just going to butt up against the ceiling of, like, yeah, I don't believe in that. So,
But I think it's not just, like, about the Catholic angle, right? I mean, I think The Exorcist really falls in line with a number of movies of that era. You know, in that post-Vietnam Manson murders, student protest era of just, like, essentially the center cannot hold. You know, like, mere anarchy has been loosed, and this was, like, such a wonderful encapsulation, or just a part of that encapsulation of that time. I mean, Stephen, you mentioned the T word, trauma. Their last franchise that he retconned, Halloween. You know, there were a bunch of jokes about Jamie Lee Curtis. Well, you know, it's actually about trauma. I think here it is also trying to be about something. It is trying to create a kind of allegory of religious solidarity, or solidarity across different religions, that it does not earn at all. You mentioned the cast. I think the acting is fine, but the writing is not there. I don't know why they brought Ellen Burstyn back for this, beyond just, like, we got Ellen Burstyn, and, like, to kind of pat on the back. They bring her in, and then she's ushered right back out. I think it was a complete waste of her character, her abilities. And yeah, I think the messages that this movie was trying to convey completely fell flat for me, and just did not seem based in, like, actually living in this country.
And Rihanna, I want to hear why you like it, because I'm really glad you do.
Yeah. Well, if I'm allowed to play devil's advocate,
yes,
please.
You are encouraged.
I'm a big advocate of, like, smooth brain content, particularly horror movies. You know what I mean? And, like, that's kind of why I didn't really mind the whole, like, oh, all religions come together aspect of this movie, because, like, I didn't think about it too hard. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I was just like, oh, okay, this makes sense. All these different characters come together for the big scene at the end.
Yeah.
And then that was, like, it for me. Mm. But I will say, like, it was gesturing at these bigger themes that I agree. Like, they did fall flat.
Yeah.
But I just kind of, like, was like, oh, okay. And then, you know, I, like, moved on. And I think that's similar to, like, how I felt about the Halloween movies, because I enjoyed the Halloween reboot. I did not like the other two sequels. They took themselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. But I think you mentioned, Mark, Talk to Me, because I think when we're talking about horror movies from the 2020s, I do think that's, like, for me at least, a golden standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated the way that Talk to Me handled, like, all of these elements that we're also seeing in The Exorcist Believer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, The Exorcist Believer doesn't take it the next logical step. It kind of is like, look at all of these things, look at all of these themes, and then it, like, stops.
Yeah.
Where's the rest of it?
There's a lack of conviction.
Yeah.
And follow through.
Yeah.
That gets at actually something that's really important to me about this whole thing, which is that I think such a huge strength of Talk to Me is Danny and Michael Philippou being, like, 30 years old and then being really dead set and really focused on the notion of building a horror movie around the anxieties and panics and fears and interpersonal, like, terrors of young people, the young people they are still attached to, these lives that they are very close to,
right,
as young individuals, particularly young Australians. And then in this movie, you have a guy who I think is probably a Gen Xer who clearly, as has been said, liked The Exorcist, and through the Blumhouse model of taking a nostalgic piece of what you liked about the original content and then not remaking it, but bringing it back, being a direct sequel to that original content and be like, hey, Ellen Burstyn's here. Let's pretend all those other movies didn't exist. And then we'll just be like, guys, remember The Exorcist and how much Ellen Burstyn like made you feel for her? Like, you take that thing that people have a sense of connection to and then you build a somewhat new story around it. You continue on from the first one. You don't reboot the first one and obliterate it. So this is very much a model. Exorcist Believer made me feel so little. It was just like, now you're doing the ultimate crime of horror to me, which is I'm bored. Ooh, and yeah. I'm just not coming out of it with anything. I'm not even offended by Believer. I'm just like, look at Leslie Odom Jr. doing a good job. Look at these little girls doing good jobs. Pats on the back to them. I hope they had a fun time on set.
I hope they got a lot of ice cream.
Yeah, I hope they made friends and lifelong connections.
But if I could compare Leslie Odom to, say, Ellen Burstyn in 73, I wasn't as taken with Odom as you two were. I don't know. Like, you think of like the fire and passion he brought to, say, Hamilton, right?
Sure.
Or even something like One Night in Miami playing Sam Cooke. I think those more realistic like scenarios, I think, play better to his strengths. And I don't know. I felt like here he was almost like he wanted to be taken seriously for the role, but he forgot to take the material seriously. There was a kind of like just there's a reticence to his presence to me, and like scenes where I really wanted like the heartache and like agony of what's happening on screen to really come through, and I just didn't feel it.
I'm curious to hear what you guys think about the thing that gave me the most mental kind of garble, which is the like Leslie Odom Jr. losing his wife in the Haiti earthquake. I thought that was like kind of random.
Here we go with a trauma plot again.
Yeah.
It's so good you brought that up because it shouldn't slide into history unmentioned. I was like, I don't know if this Haitian blessing then paired with the Haiti earthquake and being in Port-au-Prince, it was like, how did we just dabble into two things that you shouldn't just like dabble with and then just put off to the side?
And then just do nothing with.
Yeah.
These are A plot points, not B plot points. It's just like, that's like, oops, 9/11. Like, you can't just do that.
That was one of my issues with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre reboot, where they kind of brought in like mass shootings. And like, if you're going to bring in something that like grave into this arena, you better like mean it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that movie meant it. I don't think this movie here means it. Mm-hmm. I think towards the end, you can think of things like life after a catastrophe and what happened. And there's a kind of optimistic summing up that happens at the end of this movie that I do not buy. Like, the evils in this movie are inexplicable and are otherworldly, but the real evils of the world are grounded in sociopolitical forces, and they're not grounded in like in a doubt in God, which is what Leslie Odom's character has at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's just an artistic irresponsibility and like disingenuousness to me for a movie to say, you know, like, just God wants you to find peace. I'm like, all right, well, if you're really going to go there and kind of like allegorize your story, you need more than just a kind of like platitude.
I would just want to point people to the fact that Blumhouse has put out this Exorcist Believer and the movie Soft and Quiet. To me, this movie signals the official end of the horror wave that began in 2014-15 with It Follows, Goodnight Mommy, Babadook, Jordan Peele's Get Out. What was catalyzed by that, the talent and the ideas and all the good and greatness of horror is still there as it always has been, but the way that it is being purveyed by studios and the way that it has now been sort of mechanically being produced to capitalize on a sensation that
almost
studios
like
do not sort of relent now and be like, well, if Exorcist Believer bombs, then I guess like horror's not good anymore, so we shouldn't put like the resources into it that we've seen the past couple years. And thankfully A24 and Neon keep churning out like appointment stuff. But, like, I think this to me is, like, now we get to look forward to, like, the what's the next great bloom of horror that's going to happen? Because I think the last one is done.
I don't know, man. My daughter came home from Saw 10 and was, Dad, that wasn't just a good Saw movie. That was a good movie. Well, I think it's fair to say that we have strong but mixed feelings about The Exorcist Believer. We want to know what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Up next, what is making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On the Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Capital One, presenting sponsor of the 2024 Tiny Desk Contest. Earlier this year, unsigned musicians from around the country submitted their original songs for the 10th annual Tiny Desk Contest. The panel of judges are hard at work picking standout entries, and you can follow along and choose your favorite videos as well. The winner gets to play their very own Tiny Desk concert, then headline a tour with NPR Music this summer. Want to come along for the ride? Visit tinydeskcontest.npr.org to learn more, then check out the Venture X card from presenting sponsor Capital One. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details. Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how her team makes an impact.
We always do what we like to think of as actionable science. So the work that we do makes its way to things like nutrition and physical activity guidelines for cancer.org, where millions of people come each year to learn about how they can better prevent cancer.
To learn more, go to cancer.org.
Imagine a house where every room follows a different architect's plan. Doorways don't connect. Staircases lead nowhere. Lost Patients is a new podcast examining our complicated system for treating psychosis, one that loses patients to an endless loop between the streets, jail, and hospitals. We'll ask how it got so bad and how it can get better. Listen to Lost Patients from KOW and the Seattle Times, part of the NPR network.
Now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Rhianna Cruz, what's making you happy this week?
This is such a funny pivot to make after the conversation we just had. Lately, I've been falling asleep to shows on Tubi, and I think the greatest show of all time, and nobody's talking about it anymore, is How It's Made. Perfect smooth brain content. It doesn't overdo it on, like, the narration, you know? It lets you sit in these things and watch them happen.
Nice.
And it's perfect to fall asleep to, you know? I'm not the biggest fan of, like, media to fall asleep to, but I think
these
How It's Made
whale
fits
sounds.
That perfectly. Exactly, exactly.
And that's How It's Made on Tubi. Thank you, Rhianna Cruz. Jordan Cruciola, what's making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is finally at long last beginning The Americans. And I don't know how working at Vulture in the peak of that show, I managed to avoid every single spoiler about it. I'm going in totally blank. This show, you guys, did you hear about The Americans? It's so good. Yeah, it's as advertised, you guys. Get back in and watch The Americans. It's on Hulu if you haven't. Shouts out to Tubi. But Hulu, you're kicking around there.
Shouts out to Tubi.
Nice. Thank you, Jordan Cruciola. Mark Rivers, what's making you happy this week?
A show that makes me happy this week and every week since it's come out, but I've been rewatching it lately. And it's Barry Jenkins' The Underground Railroad. And I think one thing that happened with the show is that it came a little too late. It kind of came after a number of more sensationalized depictions of Black suffering and pain, like Them or Lovecraft Country or Antebellum, that's an L&A movie. And I think there was a kind of like fatigue with works that dealt in that matter. I would hope that people would give the show a chance because it is not just about the suffering. There's so much humanity and beauty in this show that Barry Jenkins has created. When I watch the show, I think of William Faulkner. I think of Alice in Wonderland. I think of the sculptress Elizabeth Catlett. I think of filmmakers like Wong Kar-wai. And but it is all filtered out through this guy's singular vision. And it feels like he is really in communion with the past, in communion with the ancestors in a way that I think it's just so beautiful and so moving. And give Underground Railroad a chance. It is unlike any show on television. It's just full visual oral immersion and just avoids all narrative cliches and expected beats.
So that's The Underground Railroad on Prime Video. We should note that Amazon supports NPR and pays to distribute some of our content. Thank you, Mark. So what's making me happy is not on streaming television. It is a musical recommendation. The singer-songwriter Omar Apollo has a new EP out called Live For Me.
Yes.
Omar Apollo has been kicking around for a few years, started out as kind of a SoundCloud artist, recorded these songs like from his bedroom in Hobart, Indiana, and is now becoming this kind of multi-genre superstar. If you haven't seen his Tiny Desk concert, I really, really recommend digging it out, where he comes out with an 11 piece band and like brings in all of these different genres in beautiful ways. There's a song on this EP called Ice Slippin'. It's the single. It is so beautiful and so like sad and dark, but sweet. It's about the experience of coming out to his family and not getting the feedback that he wants and deserves. And so it's really freighted with incredible emotion, but also just deep, deep beauty. Let's hear a little bit of it.
If I'm being honest, if I said what I said, would you hate me? Would you hate me? When you come home, is where you're supposed to be.
So that's Omar Apollo. I'm loving watching this kid become a superstar. This song is amazing. The song is Ice Slippin'. The EP is called Live For Me. And that is what is making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. Jordan Cruciola, Mark Rivers, Rihanna Cruz, thanks so much for being here.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This episode was produced by Thomas Liu and edited by Mike Katzeff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy, and Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Stephen Thompson, and we will see you all next week.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.